The Reserve Pool, Episode 21, Churning to the Next Page. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another episode of The Reserve Pool. This is number 21. We have reached drinking age for the podcast. Huzzah, huzzah. This is Dave.
This is Katie.
And this is Evan.
And we are very pleased to be with you yet again this week. We have a lot of stuff to get to in the show today, so let's start off right away with Evan, who would like to discuss a contest.
So yes, the contest is the month 3 of the OP, and we're looking to hand out 4 copies of Deflection, which I realize is maybe not the most exciting prize, as Deflection isn't exactly the best basic action, but still, if you haven't had a chance to pick it up, now is your chance.
Completionists will love it.
Yes. What we'd like for you to send us this time is... basically, who's your favorite no-show from Avengers vs. X-Men and Uncanny X-Men, now that we know that what's in Uncanny X-Men? Of course, we know what's in Avengers vs. X-Men. And we'd like to see why you wanted to see them in card and die form. Just, you know, a few sentences. Just, you know, I really love Stilt Man. His stilts are so cool. And I'm just really sad that he wasn't in there. Or if you're some unnamed person, you might want to say something about Sue Storm. I don't know.
Here's a fan?
I'm going to say you do not have to answer Sue Storm to win. We will be picking our winners at random.
Yes. Katie might root for you if you pick Sue Storm, but that's another story.
I mean, feel free to go outside the box a little bit. Obviously, I have my one character I harp on frequently. But go wild, especially if it's one of the lesser-known X-Men, because we've probably seen most of what we're going to see from the X-Men for the near term, and we're probably going to go more Avengers than hopefully Fantastic Four next box. So maybe somebody's missing from there that you wanted to see.
I bet they'll probably put a couple of the missing big stars. Where is Jubilee?
Jubilee was not in Age of Ultron.
Yeah, but neither was Phil Coulson. We know he's in.
Let's not even talk about that.
Anyway, so yeah. Send us the entries. You'll have until the Friday following when this episode will air. Not immediately following, the week after that. You do not have one day of notice. That would be mean. But
that would be mean, and we're not that mean. We're talking the 10th here. The 10th is going to be the due date as we have it right now.
And be on the lookout for the 4th contest very shortly afterwards. And, of course, we're going to read entries on the air. So, you know, if you have to say, because I have a really big crush on someone, keep that in mind.
Absolutely.
Yes, we really want to hear it. We're looking forward to some good justifications and everything else, too. That'll keep it fun, something good to share. So, yes, this should be a good one, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you send in, and I know you guys are too.
Yep.
Cool. All right, let's move on to something that we haven't had the time to do for a little while, which is the mailbag. All right, everyone. Yes, it is the return of the mailbag. Huzzah! So, if you forgot, because we hadn't actually mentioned this for a little while, you can correspond with mailbag@thereservepool.com. Though some people have certainly emailed us at Dave, Katie, and or Evan at thereservepool.com to get some thoughts as well. And some of those things have ended up being featured on mailbag as well. So if you send us something and you don't want it to go on mailbag or don't want the potential to be there, let us know and we won't do it. So I'm up first. Our first one here comes from Jason. Thank you for writing, Jason. he says some kind words first, which we appreciate, but we won't pat ourselves on the back too hard here. His question is regarding Storm, Goddess of the Plains. This is one of the storms that is dependent on you attacking with her to do the reroll. What he wants to know is, one, do we think she's overpowered? Her ability rocks and is absolutely deadly when she gets lucky and is accompanied by other attackers. And she's only 4 energy to buy and has a total fielding cost of 2. This seems insane to me. Number 2, so how do you counter her? Using an assassin or just knocking her out puts her back in your opponent's prep area, and she could just be rerolled on his or her next turn. Then she attacks and clears your field. Is the best defense against her to let her go through unblocked, hope she doesn't clean out your field, swallow the 2 or 3 punishments she'll hit you with, and let her go to the use pile, hoping to not see her again for a few rounds? Well, is she overpowered, guys? Let's start with that one.
I don't think so. I do think the 4 cost to purchase is, like, probably right on the edge. But the thing to remember is, A, it's very probability dependent. You can completely and totally wipe out your opponent's field and send all that to prep. It's entirely possible. However, you can also knock out almost nothing, which means it's kind of a waste on that front. So, yeah, there's a lot of probability there that could go in your favor and really tilt the field. On the other hand, it's a game about dice, and that can happen all on its own without Storm helping. You can have really bad luck on that front. I feel like she's on the edge, but not so much. And the big thing to remember is, if you don't wipe out your opponent on the turn she attacks and sends a lot of things to used, you're giving your opponent an incredibly energy-rich or character-rich next turn. And that could be the end of you.
Especially with all the very powerful when-fielded abilities that we have right now.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, especially since if you're knocking off a whole bunch of, or knocking out a bunch of their characters, then if a few of yours will get through, you're going to have very little to defend with the next turn. So when they feel all these characters that you've rolled off the table, maybe it's your turn, your time to get the face punches. And, you know, so you need to be careful. It's sort of a, yes, you can knock off, there I go again, knock out everything they field, but if you can't clinch the deal when you do that, you're setting yourself up for a lot of pain.
Yeah, the other thing is, when you attack, say, say it's getting towards the end and you're pretty sure that you can take your opponent out that turn, you'll take their hit points down to 0, that's entirely different than attacking with Storm with a big chunk of characters, because you know, you don't know that your big hitters are going to be able to get through. Maybe they reroll a sidekick and it's a sidekick again, which I've done and I've had done when I'm facing. And there you go, that, you know, Hulk or, Thor, or I don't know who else has, 8 attack. You know, it could still be knocked out, blocked by a sidekick. And, you know, that damage that you were maybe hoping on isn't going to happen. You don't know which characters are going to leave or stay. Maybe they've got a beast, 666 or something in there. Guess what? Character gets to block with him, gets more dice, gets a knocked out beast, making their next turn even more energy rich. So I think the thing is, since it's probabilities, and since almost nothing could go or almost everything could go, you can't do an all-in attack with Goddess of the Plains unless you're going to win anyway.
That's exactly it, because otherwise you have left the table set for your opponent's next turn, as you alluded to. So yeah, I think the answer to the second question is in the first. I really think we have covered both, because frankly, the way that you deal with her is the fact that she's there. Now, she's there and she has the drawbacks that she does have, because as we've said, she could set you up for a big turn. Of course, all of that being said, if you find that she is being a huge problem and you don't know what else to do, try out Loki Gemkeeper and keep her out of the game entirely, at least until your opponent can find a way to deal with Loki. That certainly is a way to do it, because then you don't have to worry about her going back to your opponent's prep area or anything like that. And then now your opponent has to worry about, how am I going to deal with Loki before anything else? So, Yeah, not or I don't think she's OP either. I don't think she's overpowered. And I do think that the fact that she is her and she has the drawbacks that she does have is really maybe the most effective way of dealing with her.
Yeah, but in general, I think if you don't have kind of a low-key option, sucking up 2 or 3 damage is the way to go with that.
Yep.
You know, don't KO her if you can avoid it. Send her through to used.
Yep.
Yeah, and just in case you didn't have enough options, there are a few characters coming out in UXM who will prevent your opponent from blocking. I don't remember if it's characters or actions, but there's definitely globals or abilities that will say, the rare Kitty Pride lets you pay a mask and target character can't attack this turn unless its owner plays 1 life. If it's getting down to the end of the game and, you know, they're not sure if, you know, and it comes down to, well, they really need to have, like, all your guys get knocked out and they can't afford to spend an extra life, then maybe they won't attack with Storm. And they'll wait till it's a sure thing. So that's just another way of dissuading them from doing it.
Mailbag number 2 is from David. Dave, I didn't know you sent us a mailbag.
What?
Joke about your incredibly common name. All right. So David asks us, how does Imprison work? Imprison is one of the new basic actions. The die captures any number of opposing characters with a total fielding cost of 2 or less. This effect lasts until canceled or you damage your opponent and you return the captured dice to the field. How does this action work? I read total fielding cost is a sum of all 3 character levels fielding cost. So a beast character would have a total fielding cost of 1 and Venom would have a total fielding cost of 4. And David has summarized the card pretty aptly, but just the text is, this die captures any number of opposing characters with a total fielding cost of 2 or less. And as David said, this effect lasts until canceled or you damage your opponent. And this is kind of one of those times where we collectively as a group have to kind of apologize a little bit.
Well, because we don't have to apologize.
Okay, so
WizKids has to apologize.
Yes, WizKids, why aren't you listening to us? The problem is total fielding cost, as we have been using it on the blog since almost day one, as you said, is the sum of the 3 fielding cost faces, and we use it sort of as a way to approximate how difficult it is to field that character. The thing is, I think what the imprison action means is you can capture a number of dice whose fielding cost that is showing sums to 2 or less. So you could capture infinite dice who fielded for 0 or 2 dice that field for 1 or 1 die that fields for 2.
And no 3s.
And no 3s, of
and
course.
And no 3s. Right. Hulk, big Hulks are safe.
Yeah. So so that's the thing is what I think we're looking at is you're capturing dice, you know, as I said, infinite 0s up to 2 1s or up to 1 2 worth of dice, and that effect goes until it's canceled by your opponent's action or you damage your opponent.
And I have to wonder if the infinite zeros is something that was necessarily intended with this one. I mean, it may well have been. It's a cool idea for a card, and I think it's a neat effect, but I'm not completely certain that that's what they wanted, because you could also do a 1 and infinite zeros. In fact, you could do a single 2 and infinite zeros.
Or just infinite zeros, you know?
Or just infinite zeros. So I don't know that... Can that really be what they meant? I don't know. Maybe it is.
At the same time, if they meant total fielding costs in the sense of, you know, the sum of all fielding costs on a die, that means you get at most 2 dice. And more likely 1. And it also excludes probably 70% of the dice. Because that's 1-1-1 or 0-1-2 or, you know, 1-1-2, 1-2-3, 1-2-2. All those are off the table.
Well, I'm not arguing in favor of our interpretation of it. I'm just wondering if they fully thought out the implications of the ability. That's all.
Yeah.
Because I agree. I don't think they're going for R. This is total fielding cost in lowercase letters. Ours is like TFC, the proper name, which is a metric to measure cards. And if you're wondering why we use that instead of average, that's because every average then would be decimals, and that's annoying. Not every, but many of them would be getting into decimals, and we're not going to deal with that.
Yeah, so I have a feeling that the infinite zeros is intended kind of as part of the, like, anti-weenie crusade that seems to be waged in the Uncanny X-Men set. So, yeah.
That's true.
I mean, we've definitely had some anti-weenie crusade. I will also note, technically, this could capture all sidekicks.
Yes.
Like, if you have, like, a Gobby player or something, and they have out a bunch of sidekicks, yoink.
Yes. The thing that's interesting here is that it seems like in this set and in general, and we might touch upon this a little later too, almost everything has a counter. If you're going to use villains, there's a counter. If you're not going to use villains, there's a counter. If you're going to be a weenie, there's a counter. If you're going to use large characters, there's a counter. I mean, I feel like, you know, if you're going to be mono energy or largely that, there are counters, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, there are a lot of strategies that appear to be viable at this point, but also a lot of good ways to counter those strategies that also appear to be viable. So I'm hoping that we're going to see a big variety of what's popular this one.
I think we could see a slightly more robust meta due to that, because you wouldn't be able to counter everything, and you wouldn't be able to, you know, effectively, you know, put together an offense in every sort of direction. So I think we're going to see, you know, a lot more, you know, rock, paper, scissors, and a lot less Serena, Gabi, everyone else.
Yeah, because a lot of those cards would fall to this ability in particular, very, very easily.
Yes.
A lot of beast faces have those zero costs. Serena, Gabi, etc. This is yet another one of those cards that is just like anti the entire AVX set. Like, oh, you want to use those cards? How quaint.
Nope.
We have this.
That's so 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, really.
So there you go, Dave. David.
I'm Dave.
Yes, not Dave. David. So there you go, David. It does seem like, you know, they don't mean TFC. They probably seem to mean total additive fielding cost of the character die faces shown, I think. I'm not WizKids. We're not WizKids. We don't know what they're thinking.
Well, maybe you're not WizKids.
I am collectively all of WizKids.
Wow.
All of them. Every single one.
Maybe somewhere in our hearts, we're all WizKids.
Absolutely. All right. So that wraps up the mailbag. As Dave said at the start, remember to email us at mailbag@thereservepool.com, and we'll hopefully answer your questions on the air.
All right, for our feature topic today, we are, well, sort of revisiting a discussion item that was in our second ever episode. If you look back, you see that last week we sort of revisited something from our first ever episode. The trip down memory lane isn't exactly intended here. We're not trying to mirror episode one and episode two, you know, by design here. However, with a new set coming out very shortly, and you know, the card spoilers being pretty much all out of the way here, with very few things unknown at this point, this is the time to kind of talk about these things again, because these are concepts that are important to the game, that are going to shape how we move forward. And this one is central to a game centered around dice. As we mentioned before, and back in episode two, churn. The idea of churn and the idea of tempo. Churn was our term for a whole bunch of dice moving through, getting them to move, you know, getting more dice out to roll in a turn, and all of the various strategies that you would use for that. Beast Mutate 666 being one of the quintessential churn getters. Also the Nova that lets you pull extra dice from the bag and things like that. And tempo, of course, just in general being the speed that you can play through to get to your higher cost characters, you know, faster, to get to your win condition faster than the other player. And of course, how you can stop other players from doing it. So in this set, How are we churning?
I don't think we've seen a, like, bop to draw dice or at all, have
no.
we? I mean, there's no attack to draw dice, block to draw dice, take damage to draw dice mechanic. We haven't seen one at all.
It's not here.
Which is interesting because there were two or three, at least two.
Yeah. Quasar
and 666 in the last set. So maybe they realized they don't like that. I mean, there was also kind of the Silver Surfer Global, which lets you pay life to get more dice. So pay life to get dice. So they're gone. At least, I mean, we haven't seen one. We're missing a few cards. It's always possible it's hiding somewhere and hasn't been seen yet. But we've seen almost the whole set and it isn't here. So is that a lesson learned or a mistake or what?
Well, I don't know. I think that I don't think that they really intended Beast Mutate 666 to be in everything. In the last set. I don't think that they did anyway. Generally, companies try to avoid that. Of course, there was that, I guess a recent example in Magic, somewhat recent, was a card called Skull Clamp, which wasn't necessarily like overpowered on its own, but had some cool interactions, and it just turned out to be in everything. And if it wasn't in something, then you had to plan for it. And ultimately, what Wizards of the Coast did was ban it in most formats. I had one of those. I don't know if I accidentally sold it or not when I got rid of my Magic cards, which makes me sad. But all that being said, I don't know that they intended Mutate 666 to be all over the place, used the way that he was. Certainly, it was a good card, and certainly those mechanisms are important in any kind of deck-building game, right? Things that let you draw more cards are there, and this has its roots in a deck-building game. But you're right. We don't have that straightforward draw-die.
Yeah,
card here. But we do have ways to kind of get around that. We do have things that let us get some dice, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really one of those questions of how that's going to shake out in the OP specifically and the draft formats, since that doesn't look to be an option so far. But we do have some options, and I think we'll probably continue to talk about the elephant in the room repeatedly.
yeah. Who, the best option here is?
That would be Professor X. And I think we're looking at both his common and his rare, as I recall.
I believe that's the case. Yeah, we're looking at the global ability here.
Recruiting young mutants is additional sidekick tutoring as well. So, cost six, but if you weren't here last week, it's global. Pay mask. Move up to two sidekick dice from your used pile to your prep area. So, apparently, we've changed from bop to draw dice to pay mask to draw dice. It's only sidekicks. You don't have the option like Beast did to kind of stumble upon a character die, but sidekicks are energy pretty much uniformly.
Evan?
Yeah, no, I mean, there isn't a lot to say to that. There isn't a lot more to say about that. It's a pretty good engine for drawing dice. You search your bag for dice, you use those dice, then you put them back in your prep area, and your dice is free of all your dice bag is free of all those pesky sidekicks forever.
Yeah, I mean, his fielded ability does that, and you might say, well, he's a six-cost character. How am I going to get that fast? But with the global ability, moving some sidekicks from your used pile to your prep area, you're going to be able... You could buy if your rolls go well, you could buy a six-cost character on turn two, which is crazy to me.
Turn three.
Yeah, there's no way you can do it on turn two.
Because
if you save that mask for your opponent's turn and do it then.
Okay, fine. If you want to do the before your turn ends mask paying that we talked about in the new.
It's just anywhere before at the end of your main phase. I do this. There's nothing wrong with that, and I think we're going to see a lot of people do it. It can be done. Then you can buy a six cost character on turn two with Professor X and good rolls.
Yep, it's true. Yep.
You don't even need good rolls. You just need
one mask.
You need a mask energy.
Yeah.
On the next turn, you need all six.
You need six energy, yeah.
All six sidekicks have to go, which is sometimes easy, sometimes not.
Which isn't that hard to do, but...
Nah.
Statistically, the odds are in your favor if you're going for that.
They are. They really are. This is the guy. This is it. This is the one. We're going to see him a lot. Let's circle back around to him because I think there's a larger conversation to be had about Professor X. And I know we've gotten a couple of email requests to really dig into him. And we're going to do that a little bit later on in the episode. But he's not the only one who's helping us get some dice out faster, right? A lot of it does seem to be pertaining to sidekicks right now. But that's okay because sidekicks... I don't necessarily want sidekicks as often after a point. If I can go into my bag and draw four characters, I'm pretty happy. So one of those options is Angel's new common, which is air transport. When fielded, you may field a sidekick from your used pile, spin it to its character side. So that means that there's a sidekick in your used pile that's now all of a sudden not going to end up in your bag. You also have him to attack block. He's your chump block or whatever else.
Yeah, I think Angel is sort of like almost a reverse Gambit, kind of. Gambit was very good for hopefully pulling out like sidekicks or dice you didn't want to end up rolling and kind of sending them straight to used was one of the things that he was particularly good for, and Angel's kind of on the opposite side. If the sidekick makes it to your used pile, you can bring him back. So hopefully you still cycle through your bag a little more quickly, just kind of in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Well, and very similar to that is Namor's rare. If he's the only character in your field at the end of any turn, field up to two sidekick dice from your used pile or prep area. Again, spin them to the character face. I would probably want to take them again from the used pile. If they're in my prep area, I want to roll that energy the next turn if I can. But in general, you know, between Namor, Professor X, and Angel, what they all do, though, is deal with your sidekicks and help you have fewer of them cycling through your bag.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, these all... pull the sidekicks out of your cycle.
Yeah. No, my question really, I guess my question here is for Evan, really, because you've done so much of the analysis with some of the probabilities and everything else within the game. If we have less of these sidekicks going through, I mean, we're going to have a lot more opportunity to pull characters from the bag. So on the one hand, that can mean more energy because of the double energy phases, but it could also mean like a turn where you get like four characters and all of them are like, you know, you can't field any of them because they all cost something. So where's like the happy medium going to be here?
Well, I think the thing to remember is we're not like banishing our sidekicks to the used pile forever. They're going to keep bouncing back and forth from prep to field to use, or just prep to use as we, you know, use them for energy. So it seems like, especially with Professor X around, you're probably going to have two sidekicks in your prep area with your four dice almost all the time. So, you know, you will have this base of energy. And I really think that one of the things you're going to need to consider is when you're building your team, you want to have a couple of characters who are probably cheaper to buy, cheaper to field, who you can say, you know, these are, especially later on when you're really trying to get those six cost dice and those guys who cost three out, where, you know, maybe several twos in a turn, you really want to have a few characters who they help you in the beginning and they have some use at the end, but you don't mind rolling them for energy. As opposed to, you know, do I want to roll this guy for energy or, because otherwise I can't field my big guy, but I want his, you know, throws things in the air power. And that's never a good place to be. And you have to have a few characters you don't mind, you know. You know, maybe you're playing a villain deck and you took the common Wanda, a common Scarlet Witch, who, you know, it's nice to have a 5-3 earlier on. She can maybe do some damage with her ability. But later on, you know, when your apocalypses are all stomping about and you're all happy, just roll her for energy so your big guys can get it.
Do you think we're going to see the beginning of, like, a more developed energy curve given this?
I also feel that so far what I've seen, there's a lot less of the everybody is 1, 2, 3. There's a lot more of, you know, good 2-cost stuff. So I think 2 is going to be sort of the sweet spot people are looking, like, multiples of 2. Like, maybe 4 means you get your big expensive characters. So if you're rolling 4 character dice, if 2 roll as energy and 2 roll as characters, what you'd expect, you should be able to pay for them. So, you know, if you pull one of them out of the equation with those 2 sidekicks, then you know, you've got some spare energy to buy stuff. Or maybe you don't roll one of your characters and you buy a 6 and then you field something for cheap, or who knows. But I do think that they've also changed the shape of, you know, where we're spending. It's not going to be so much we have a swarm of things that cost nothing, so it doesn't matter that we have no spare dice for energy. Or we have, and though I will note, you still can do that. It's not like there are no zero cost characters in the set. There's just fewer of them. And I'm not even saying some of them are bad. 3-1 and Ant-Man isn't terrible. And Black Panther is 4-2.
Yeah, Kitty Pryde has a 3-2 face. Yeah.
Right. And Magic is a 1-6 for nothing. If you actually pair her with Ant-Man, you can flip that around. She's a 6-1. So, you know, that's nice for a surprise kicking your opponent's teeth.
Well, and I think supporting what you guys are saying here, especially, Katie, your point about a more developed cost curve, and I think we speculated about this several weeks ago. You know, right now, as we know, common Ant-Man and common Kitty Pryde still do not have an ability text. So we are looking really at 2-cost characters that are relatively cheap to field, right? The total fielding cost of just 1, 2 faces at 0 there. You can get early on in purchase and ultimately have out for maybe chump blocking earlier, a little cheap shot, but mostly energy. And I'll note that Kitty Pryde here is mask, and Ant-Man here is providing us fist energy.
We've also seen the Falcon has a shield 2-cost with a stat line similar to Angel's with no ability text as well.
That's correct. You know what? He's missing from the spoiler list that I'm looking at, it, as well as some of the ones that we've covered on the site. So good catch there. Yeah, so we have a few options here from those dice, and a lot of those, what we don't have is a bolt like that, but I think that's okay.
We have a no-ability bolt, but it's the common, it's one of the Icemen. And
But that's a cost 4.
That is a cost 4, so
I don't know that I care as much about that one. That one's a weird card, and I don't understand. It should be cost 2.
I honestly think it makes sense given Pyro.
Well, that's fair. Yeah, what I was going to say is we have so many other ways of getting bolts right now.
Right, and I think a 2-cost character, a 2-cost bolt character, comboed with the rare Pyro would be kind of brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think we are going to see a real structure here, and that's pretty cool. And, of course, if somebody does go with a lot of the chumps and some of the zero fielding cost characters, a lot of them, well, that's why we have Imprisoned.
Right.
And we just talked about that in Mailbag, so.
Yep.
And I do think that, you know, as much as we say, you know, the rush game, you know, this will really shape the rush game, I think you can still do a rush. You know, you could certainly try and swarm your opponent with Ant-Man and, you know, other cheap characters. And then there are characters like X-23 Assassin, who's relatively cheap for something that can be as big as 7, you know, as a 7 attacker. Or Black Panther, who's even worse, though you have to do a little dance to get around to his attack conditions. You know, you can still definitely go for that quick kill. It just requires a bit more finesse to do it with some of the power guys you have, and you won't have as many, you don't have quite as many brutal options. So it's now a legitimate option as opposed to the best option.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Very true. I like that development.
Which is good. I liked it in Magic where, you know, you could win with a weenie deck, but it wasn't the only way to win.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that does bring us around then to, I think it does anyway, brings us back around to the question of Professor X.
I actually wanted to throw one more thought in here first. And that's actually about Mr. Sinister Nathaniel Essex and Magneto, Will to Live. And there might be others that I'm missing on this one. But both of these cards, when they're knocked out, they come back. So Will to Live, Magneto. If Magneto leaves the field, he goes to your prep area instead of your used pile. And ditto with Nathaniel Essex. If he's KO'd.
There's actually at least one of the Sabretooths and the rare Apocalypse also have a similar
effect. The Mr. Sinister also requires that a sidekick be knocked out in the same turn.
Yes, it's true. They're not all the exact same, but they're pretty much the idea of when they're KO'd, sometimes you can fulfill a condition that will send them back either straight to the field or back to your prep area rather than your used pile. And, I mean, this isn't really churn, but it's kind of...
It's a safety net.
Safety net. Leaves your big guys on the field or close to coming back. And I think that's interesting as well, where some of these characters, you put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into buying them and fielding them, and then they, go away very quickly, but you have this ability to bring them back, with certain conditions fulfilled. And I think that's going to be interesting as well to see trying to have one of these characters available that's kind of constantly fielded.
Right, and the other thing here, too, is that some of these characters are a little bit higher cost, right? Magneto is six total fielding cost. Mr. Sinister is five. So if you don't have to get them off the field, then you also don't have to pay to refuel them on a future turn. If Mr. Sinister getting to return to the field if the sidekick is knocked out. Magneto, maybe not so much because he is just going to the prep area. But at the same time, you could roll him as energy and then do something else with that. So the fact that you have the ability to keep them around saves you time in terms of getting it through your bag or just helps keep that crucial character or energy available. So, yeah, it's not churn per se, but it can be a cost savings in the long run.
Yeah, so I just think that's a thought that maybe we'll see, especially since there seem to be four characters that already have this a similar mechanic, and we might even see one or two more, given that we're not completely spoiled. At this point, I think it could be interesting. The idea of you put these resources into getting these characters into your dice bag, and then they stick around.
Yeah. We were talking a moment ago about some of the weenie options that we have here, and also some of the big characters, and how's that going to affect the cost curve and everything else. And that does bring us around, as we promised, back to Professor X. He's going to make so many things simpler because of that global, because of the ability to kind of spend one and then bank two energy for later. He's going to give us the ability to get to some of the bigger characters a little bit faster. So I guess the question here is, are we going to see Professor X all over the place? I feel like we are, because you can't necessarily guarantee that your opponent is going to have it. If your deck is wanting for that kind of ability, you're going to have to bring him.
He kind of reminds me of what Magneto became in the last set. That sort of like, well, I don't really need him necessarily, but... There's that global pay mask, 50-50 shot of getting rid of a villain. And I think he's going to become that, that character that doesn't necessarily get fielded. Although, unlike Magneto, Professor X doesn't self-defeat himself.
he actively, at least for his common, he actively helps himself.
Yeah, so you could definitely buy that Professor X, like you said, on your second turn, and he will make your energy efficiency or your energy throughput or something better, by the time he starts coming to the field. Sadly, TFC 6, but this is beside the point. I think he might be, if not the B666, the Magneto of the set.
But with a more universally useful ability.
Yeah.
Right. I wonder how many people, though, won't bring him just gambling on the fact that, you know, he's so useful. Surely my opponent will bring him.
It's true. I think it's going to be a matter of if we keep seeing, like, Rainbow or we style or we see Constructed. I think in Constructed you're going to want to bring him because just like Beast, he puts you behind the energy curve if you don't bring him. On the other hand, your opponent might bring him and you could focus more on a natural energy curve progression, possibly. And if Professor X is in the offering from your opponent, you can take advantage of it. So you might not want it to be one of your eight cards. But if he shows up on your opponent's set, you're good. So yeah, he might be Magneto's. Like if I don't bring him, my opponent will.
Right. Though what I'm trying to look at here is to find out the other side of it. Like what decks wouldn't want to have that ability? And that's where I think I have a hard time being sure of it. If you were going to try to rush small characters, you probably aren't going to spend the time to buy or to pay for that global ability, I suppose. But, you know, your opponent might have him anyway. I don't see a way that he's not going to end up being in most of the matches. And is that okay?
Yeah, I think the problem is that since he does have so much opportunity to shift the early cost, that he might be an auto-include.
Yeah.
I think almost the problem here is I think what they need to do is have a couple of cards that do similar things, but kind of get in each other's way, perhaps. You know, because, like, you could bring Beast and Nova last set. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not necessarily super useful, although Nova is a pretty beefy five purchase cost character. It might be interesting if there was, like, Professor X and, like, a character that stepped on his toes as well.
It would be very funny if it was the uncommon Magneto, which I don't think we've seen yet.
Yeah, I don't remember which that one is. We've seen it on the side of a box, which I awesomely used to predict he was in the starter kit. I don't think we've seen that one. Could be interesting. It could happen. I think it would involve perhaps, I don't know how you would step on that particular ability's toes, keeping psychics out of the used pile, perhaps.
Yeah. With all of the turn affecting sidekicks, I think we also have to mention here that these new rules do affect things. The idea of the transit area, the transit zone, or the dice that are in transit, however we want to term this, the subway, as Evan put it last episode, it does limit your possible churn to an extent, because there is going to be the ability for you to just not have something that's actually in used for you to grab. A lot of the churn here does involve grabbing things from used, which you're not going to be able to do as much anymore with the changes. And I have to think that was something that was very much meant to happen. I don't think they were happy with people just like, boom, I have all these dice and you're dead.
Yeah. I feel like possibly the post your main phase, the post your opponent's main phase, you know, might be where that breaks down a little bit, especially with the globals like Professor X, as opposed to the ones that are like on field. I think it really means, though, that the games are going to get a little nitpicky. And I'm not sure how I feel about that. It's like these dice are, you know, on the subway and these dice are in used and these dice are in prep. And there's just a lot of places for dice to be and a lot of times when you can't move them between those places. So I think it's going to be a little more confusing. I know some people were complaining, not necessarily because it affected gameplay so much as because it was even more complicated. Yeah. So yeah. I don't know.
I don't agree with that thought. I certainly understand that point, that point of view, but I don't agree with it. If I think of Pokemon, the collectible card game, I have my hand, I have my bench, I have my Pokemon who's out on the bench, I have my prize pool, I have my discard pile, I have my draw pile. There's seven distinct zones that you have cards. Magic the Gathering, you have your characters, you have your creatures who are out, equipment that's attached to them, enchantments somewhere else, your land, your hand, your discard pile, and your library. In Netrunner, God, you have cards everywhere on that, and they're in totally different places depending on which side of the board you are. I don't think that adding the transit idea to Dice Masters complicates. Do I think it's slightly more complicated than it was? Yes. But do I think that it puts dice in so many more places than we're used to having components in a game like this? No, not at all. I mean, Netrun is the best example.
I honestly feel like it's going to probably just make sort of a condition. There's things that you want to do on your turn, but you can't because of the transit zone. So when do you do them? At the beginning of your opponent's turn. It's just like Magic, where, you know, there are certain, you know, at the end of my opponent's turn, I twiddle this and this and this, so this can be ready for my turn. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, it becomes part of the game.
It's just strategic, and you have to be able to think in those ways. Just like we've talked in other episodes about thinking about, well, you know what? I could use Nog to damage my own character, and now he's in the prep area, which is awesome. Or whatever else. You know, it's just different ways of using the abilities that you have, sometimes seemingly against yourself. You know, I can't think of a thematic way to justify, like, your character intentionally damaging something else so that it goes to the prep area. I mean, it seems weird in terms of the game itself. Like, you know, Spider-Man's just going to turn and punch Cyclops in the face, and now Cyclops is in prep. But, you know, whatever. I mean, maybe Goblin's chaotic enough that it makes sense for Nog, but still. It's being creative. It's adding more strategy and layers of thought to the decisions that you're going to make, and that's cool. There's nothing wrong with that. Do I want to save this mask to use for Professor X or to use some other global ability? Maybe if he decides to attack. Oh, no, he didn't attack. Now I couldn't do that. I maybe should have done it earlier. So you really have to think through your options a little more, and that's cool.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting because all we've seen by way of these things that seem to bring more energy into your prep area do seem very focused on sidekicks. And so it's going to be very important to know where your sidekicks are.
It's 3 a.m. Do you know where your sidekicks are?
Yeah. I think the idea is that, you know, you want to know where your sidekicks are going, and ideally in most cases you probably want them bouncing between your use pile and your prep area and never really going into your dice bag unless you're monkeying around with whether or not you want the uncommon magic to teleport people in and out of combat. And because most of the time you don't really want to be playing those sidekicks, you just want to have them around.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. I think he's kind of expensive, but I was looking at Juggernaut Kane Marco, one of his starter box versions, which is when Juggernaut takes damage, you may move any or all of your sidekicks to your use pile and prevent up to 3 damage to Juggernaut per sidekick moved. I think the phrasing of that is wrong. But at the same time, it's one of those things where you've got so many guys focused on pushing sidekicks onto the board that there's one or two that also seem to focus on getting the sidekicks back off and into your used pile. So you have kind of this complicated sidekick dance of where are your sidekicks? Send them to use, send them to prep, send them to the... Yeah, so I don't know. It's going to be very confusing. Watch the sidekicks. It's like a little cup game.
It's a shell. Yeah, I was going to say it's a shell game. Absolutely.
With the sidekicks.
Yeah. So please, everybody out there, share your thoughts with Churn in this new set with us. Keep in mind that with WizKids' history, in terms of especially things like HeroClix, in the organized play events anyway, in the big leagues here, we're probably going to see a lot of just this set. When you figure draft, it's going to be just Uncanny X-Men packs. When you figure, you know, the Rainbow Draft is one of the formats they're strongly urging here, and frankly, I think is a lot of fun. It's really, if you haven't tried it yet, please try it. It's cool. This is going to be very centric to just this set. There's nothing saying that you can't play casually on your own or however your game store decides to arrange things for casual play or store in-store tournaments to use everything, but WizKids is going to heavily push for things that are going to be just this set. That's my prediction. I stand by it. I've stood by it for a while, and that's because that's pretty much what they do with HeroClix. Hey, we're having a Fear Itself event. Come with two characters and buy a booster and then make your team, or buy two boosters and make your team, or whatever else. They love that stuff. That's how they operate. That's just what it is. Yeah, let us know your thoughts on Churn and how you're going to react to this set and what you're going to do to rush your characters. What global abilities can you use in a way that we hadn't thought of here in this episode? What are your plans? Tell us, tell us, tell us. And you can do that in the comments section to this podcast. You can also do it mailbag@thereservepool.com. Follow us on Twitter. Leave some reviews on iTunes. I actually haven't checked on those for a little bit, so we'll bring that back later on. But we do really very much appreciate your support and everything that you're doing to help us get the word out there. Thank you so much. That brings us to the end of this episode of The Reserve Pool. We look forward to seeing you again in one more week. And bye.
Goodbye.
Bye, guys. And gals.
Everybody.
Everybody, yes.
He has the silliest sneezes.